The truth is, I knew it was you. Now, maybe I didn't get the cuffs on you, but I knew.
Oh, people only know what you tell them, Carl.
Well, then tell me this, Barry Allen, Secret Service. How did you know I wouldn't look in your wallet?
The same reason the Yankees always win. Nobody can keep their eyes off the pinstripes.
That's a clip from the 2002 Steven Spielberg movie, Catch Me If You Can. It's based on the true story of the legendary con man, Frank Abagnale. Con men and con women show up a lot in Kevin Young's book, Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. Bunk began as a slim meditation about a few hoaxers Kevin has known, but then it morphed into a sprawling blunderbuss of a book that explores the history of the hoax all the way from the 1800s to our present day. So why did Kevin decide to write this book?
It wasn't even so much personal as just I became fascinated by the history of this, and I started to really realize that the hoax had a long history, especially in the U.S., and what did that mean? Is the hoax something particularly American? And I came to understand the ways it was American, which isn't to say that there weren't hoaxes before the United States, but that we perfected it in some way. The idea of the con artist and the con man is an American phrase and idea. And, you know, we sometimes go back and forth whether we admire con men, like in Catch Me If You Can or other sort of movies that glorify that, or if we're, you know, really upset with that. And I think you see that kind of writ large right now in this era where fakery is really at hand. You can see it almost happening live in front of your eyes. And some of the technology we have, from the internet to television to even like now people talking about AI and what AI can do, work on that principle. And I'm not sure we've really wrestled with fully with the ethical and moral questions that that raises.
Yeah.
And those are what really got me going and realizing there was much more to the hoax than simply, you know, fun and games.
Yeah, definitely. You say that race and hoaxes go hand in hand because race is also a fake thing pretending to be real. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I came to really understand that in the 19th century, where I trace the hoax from and P.T. Barnum, is really when, you know, our ideas, our modern ideas of race and sort of different races and what the particular races are and these kind of hierarchies of race evolved. And that's also the height of the hoax. That's when the hoax really takes off and goes from, you know, something that someone individual might conjure up to something that P.T. Barnum perfected and turned into a kind of not only a show, but almost a kind of national treasure and technique. And that kind of combination, I think, is really powerful. And you start to see the ways that Barnum's early hoaxes made use of race, whether it was him showing Joyce Heth, who was, he claimed, George Washington's nursemaid, which would have made her 161 years old, to his other hoaxes where he pretended, you know, that he found the missing link, who he called What Is It? Question mark. And it turned out to be a black man dressed up in sort of animal costume, but not really. You know, he almost was kind of half-hearted about some of the hoaxes because he didn't have to do it that much because there was this kind of other narrative of race that was filling in the blanks for people. And I think that that narrative is very much with us. And the ways that race is fake are that we know it doesn't have a scientific basis, yet we rely on it. It doesn't mean that, of course, racism isn't real. It's quite the opposite. And I think because race and, say, blackness specifically is a culture that has created wonderful things that I, you know, think about in other parts of my work and talk about music, writing, et cetera. But also that, you know, race itself is this way that people separate themselves and divide themselves, and they use it often to fake from and with. And that kind of divide that people use is one the hoax goes to all the time. You see people pretend to be Native American, for instance, or take on this other role and play the exotic. And I sort of trace how that comes down to even today.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. As you write in Bunk, Native Americans have long been the subject of hoaxes. There was Buffalo Bill's Wild West shows, which ran in the 1880s and up until 1910s. These shows featured reenactments of Indian attacks. There were also Red Face and people like Nazdij and Gray Owl who pretended that they were Native Americans. How has the relationship between the hoax and Native Americans cemented this idea of the imaginary Indian stereotype?
Well, you see it every Halloween, you know. We just passed Halloween, and you see this kind of parade of people who insist on dressing up in inauthentic ways, like real people. And it's really a puzzling kind of moment. And blackface, you see all these kind of that American history of masquerade that isn't so innocent in these instances. And I think that you see in the hoaxes the ways that it isn't just that people are pretending to be Native, though they are, that is troubling, but also what they also say about that then, you know, and same thing with blackness. It's often that it's a form of extinction, you know, or that it's on the way out, or it's only ridiculous. And I think that I try to trace it in the book through the centuries, and some of it is realizing that, say, blackface emerges at exactly the same time, almost the same year, 1835, as Joyce Heth, which I think is an interesting and not coincidence. And same thing with when you see the Native American kind of masquerades and red face, as you said. So trying to understand that part of American history, which is complicated, is what I do in the book.
More recently, you talk about a lot of the journalistic hoaxes we've been seeing over the past several years, including Stephen Glass, Jason Blair, and Janet Cook. And you ask the question, why are there all of these imaginary black people in these journalistic hoaxes? And then you rephrase the question as, why are there all of these fantasies about black men who do not actually exist? What do you think the answer is?
Well, those figures are fascinating. And they hoaxed at the Washington Post and the New York Times and the New Republic. So, you know, it's across sort of very prestigious parts of journalism.
Okay, I'm trying to keep cool about all this, but you know the Uniform Computer Security Act and the glass piece? Supposed to be under debate in 21 state legislatures? I just checked all 50. No such act.
Beautiful.
And Julie Farthwork from the Computer Security Center? Not too sure she exists either. Same with Jim Gord of the Center for Interstate Online Investigations.
And I've got nothing of the National Assembly of Hackers or Frank Juliet.
Do you know why this is so great? I mean, do you see the irony here? The New Republic, snobbiest rag in the business, the in-flight magazine of Air Force One, and their star goes out and gets completely snowed by a bunch of hackers. I mean, God couldn't have written this any better.
I think that for me, some of the more troubling is Janet Cook. She won a Pulitzer for her famous story about Jimmy, this young drug addict who didn't exist. But I also try to trace it to other hoaxes where, you know, people invent a black man came and held me up, you know. You know, Susan Smith, who said a black man abducted her children when she had really done it. When Charles Smith had murdered his pregnant wife, I was in Boston. And it was all in the news, and it affected actual black people who got frisked and stopped and harassed, thinking they were suspects. And, you know, picking that kind of suspect, the perfect victim we sometimes hear about. This was like the perfect suspect. And you sort of see that continue. And I was trying to trace that and how that flows into journalistic hoaxes.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about Janet Cook is that she is African-American.
Yeah. She was black. And so was Jason Blair. But, you know, so there was that. I tried to understand the ways that race plays out in the newsroom, but also plays out in our stories about ourselves, which is what I think journalism helps us to do and think about. Why do people believe these stories that when you look back on them are so obviously fake? In the case of Stephen Glass, making up really unbelievable stories. But one of the things that I realized about the hoax is believability is actually not what it's going for. It's going for the outrageous. So it's so unbelievable, you hardly have time to stop and think.
Yeah, so that question of why do people believe these hoaxes, is it partly in part because they want to believe?
I think so. I mean, I started the book really trying to understand why we deceive each other. And by the end, I really started thinking about why we believe. And why do we believe the worst of each other? Why are things as bad as we fear they are in the hoax?
Yeah. Do you think that the hoax is always political?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that hoaxes often have elements of power in them. It's, mm-hmm. it's you know, in the end, it becomes who can hoax.
Yeah.
You know, who's able to say, oh, it doesn't matter, I'm Native, you know, and isn't really. And I think that that freedom to pretend is one of the things that I think you see people resist, say, on Halloween. And they don't want to tie it to sort of white racism. They want to tie blackface to freedom to be something else. And I think that's a really interesting dynamic that we have. But I also, you know, about journalistic hoaxes, I want to really make clear that I think journalism isn't a hoax. I think journalism done right, and I think it's mostly done right, is a way of examining and investigating. It has elements of skepticism in it that are meant to help us and protect us and ask tough questions. And I really want to make clear of that because sometimes people tend to, when they hear of a journalistic hoax, they tend to dismiss an entire genre that I think has provided us some of our greatest freedom and is a really important part of our American fabric of life.
Yeah.
And it's under attack, you know, and I want us to understand the ways that the hoax is a way of attacking it. It's not the state of things.
And speaking of the present, we now find ourselves living in what you call the age of euphemism, and you identify President Donald Trump as the modern version of P.T. Barnum. What does Trump have in common with Barnum?
Well, I think that, you know, I was really trying to I've been writing, as I said, this book for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And then the election happened, and suddenly the idea of fake news took hold in this way that I had been writing about,
yeah.
but didn't know that would be so ubiquitous. And I think what's interesting about the moment now we're in is it isn't just that fake news is something that people are concerned about, but it's an accusation that then invalidates all news. And it's also, instead of saying, like, I'm going to hoax you, I'm going to call you a hoax. That's the ultimate insult right now. And, you know, it goes from everything to, you know, we can't have a national tragedy or a shooting and have a conversation about it without people saying it's all pretend.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a really strange place to be in. And we have to be honest about that. That's where we're at. And my book is trying to understand how we got here. Mm-hmm. And think, you know, in the last bits of it, it tries to understand the ways that, say, plagiarism or something like that also is about a larger sign of this cynicism that's cropped up. And I think the cynicism if we think at all about such things, might protect us against fakery, but it actually leads us to believe more fakery because we can't know what's real. We don't trust what's real. And so when we hear a story that's quite good, we tend to hold on to it. It matches what we want, as opposed to the truth, which sometimes can be really tough. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we need to be, is in those tough conversations and places and admissions. And it can't be that we're denying what actually happened.
Yeah, yeah. At the end of your book, you ask a very provocative question in the last paragraph. I'd like to have you read it, if you don't mind.
Sure. What if truth is not an absolute or relative, but a skill, a muscle like memory, that collectively we have neglected so much that we have grown measurably weaker at using it? How might we rebuild it, going from chronic to bionic? The facts are on our side. Let's hope the fictions, once again, will be too.
Thank you. Do you think that we can rebuild our truth muscle and become better able to use it?
I do think so. In a weird way, working on this book has made me hopeful about it. It sort of gives us a sense of at least where we've been, and that sometimes we've been in bad places of fakery, and they tend to be about a lot of different things. You know, I think race is very much part of that, but it's also cyclical, and that up and down quality. I think we're definitely in a down patch or a big patch, depending on how you think of it in terms of fakery. But we're also, you know, that means that maybe there's a chance we can get past that. And for me, when I say that about the fictions being on our side, I think one of the things that is so destructive about the hoax is that the hoax also damages our idea of art, you know, and it does, and the imagination. And it kind of says the imagination isn't worth relying on, and that the imagination, that something pretend can't move us because it has to be true, even if it's, you know, faked and hoaxed. So hoaxers are pretending things are true in order for us to believe them, because somehow we can't be moved by the Great Gatsby or someone imagined, you know. Whereas we know from our lives and the power of stories that something made up can move us.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
And, you know, my friend Colson Whitehead's novel, The Underground Railroad, is so powerful because it does take this imaginative leap in what if it's an actual railroad.
Yeah,
and definitely. And I think one of the reasons it's so powerful is it becomes an emblem, a symbol. And that's how art can move us, and it can make us think about our lives in new ways, without asking us to believe something that isn't true.
Kevin Young is the author of Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. You can find out more about Kevin at WPR.org/beta. No, seriously, you really can.
I thought he meant that they allowed people to smoke in the library. I really had no clue about anything that would be referring to a fire.
New Yorker staff writer Susan Orlean joins us to talk about the devastating Los Angeles library fire of 1986. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.